Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, the New Democrats welcome a new member to Queen's Park as the party wins the Hamilton Centre by-election. But there's a lot more to the story than that.
This week, the province brings down its budget for the next fiscal year. Finance Minister Peter Bethlenfalvy gives us a sneak peek on how budget making really works.
And this province doubles down, triples down, maybe quadruples down on EVs with another big announcement for southwestern Ontario.
It's March 21st, 2023, so let's get to it.
Hey, partner, how you doing?
Good, you know. Good weekend, you?
Absolutely. Went to Ottawa this past weekend.
Oh, and what brought you to the nation's capital?
The Maple Leafs, because it's very difficult to get and or afford a ticket for the Leafs at the Scotiabank Arena. But if you go to Ottawa, not only can you afford the price of the ticket, but half the crowd's on your side as well. It's almost a home game for the Leafs when they play in Ottawa. Anyway, lots of fun. Leafs won in a 9-round shootout. You have no idea what I just said, but people who follow hockey will know that that's a great thing.
I understand vaguely that that is an exciting outcome.
Yes, indeed. Just before we get to our three issues, did you see the poll from Angus Reid last week about the popularity of all the premiers in Canada?
I did see that. That was an interesting one.
Now, would you have guessed who the most popular premier in all of Canada is right now?
So I think it's a mark of how little crossover there's been between Ontario and Newfoundland politics in the last few years that, no, I could not have guessed that Andrew Furey, premier of the easternmost province, is currently the country's most popular.
Well, for the record, yes, Premier Furey of Newfoundland and Labrador is the most popular premier in the country. And here are the first, let me go through the first seven here, because they've got pretty good approval ratings. Furey is at 62%. Scott Moe from Saskatchewan is at 60%. Premier King of Prince Edward Island at 58%, Dennis King. François Legault, Quebec, 55%. Tim Houston, Nova Scotia, 51% approval rating. That's all above water. You got to like that if you're one of those guys. David Eby, British Columbia, 48%. And how about Danielle Smith, who came in under such controversy in Alberta? She's at 46% approval rating. That's the top seven. But then something kind of happens after that.
Yes, bit of a drop-off.
Yeah, a bit of a drop-off between Danielle Smith and the next three. You want to take us through that?
Sure. Well, the next premier in our list is Ontario's premier, Doug Ford, at 33%. Blaine Higgs in New Brunswick at 25%. And Heather Stephenson in Manitoba also at 25%. So, yeah, pretty steep fall-off there.
It's pretty interesting that there seems to be such a gap between what Doug Ford is doing personally and what the PC party is doing provincially, because you would think that the party and the leader would be reasonably close together in their approval numbers, but not the case here.
No, and you know, we're going to focus on the Ontario data here for obvious reasons. I find it very interesting that Ford is so low here because, as you say, he was in a higher, or the PC party, rather, was in a higher standing. And we're still not seeing a very strong challenge from any of the other parties in the legislature. They're still quite far back. So it's not exactly clear why Ford would be 7 points behind his party. It's probably a bit early to start pulling the fire alarm in the premier's office. But I do want to note that according to Angus Reid, he's about where he was approval-wise during the lowest points of his last term in 2021, when the province was going through numerous unpopular COVID lockdowns.
Very curious. Very curious. Just a reminder that you can get in touch with us by emailing us at onpolitics@tvo.org. Happy to hear any of your comments, good, bad, or indifferent, as they say. Now, on to issue one. JMM, there's an old expression, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And you could certainly say that about Hamilton Centre and the by-election they had there last week. Just a reminder for our listeners, this was the by-election to replace former NDP leader Andrea Horvath, who left provincial politics to run for mayor of Hamilton. Last June, Horvath got 57% of the total votes cast in Hamilton Centre. Last week, NDP candidate Sarah Jama got 54%. Almost the same. A bit of good news for the Liberals. Their vote went up 7 points. But of course, the story around this by-election hasn't been the fact that the NDP vote essentially stayed the same. The story has been some of the controversial statements the NDP candidate, now future MPP, has made during her career as a political activist.
Right. Sarah Jama certainly wanted to create a lot of attention for her candidacy because she will become the first MPP in Ontario history to use a wheelchair on the day of her election. So there was a certain amount of excitement around the possibility of her focusing a lot more attention on disability rights issues. I very strongly suspect that she will be the disabilities critic for the NDP when she takes her seat in the legislature. She's also a black woman in a chamber in which there aren't very many black people, particularly with the announcement that Kitchener Centre MPP Laura May Lindo will be quitting politics later this year. So Jama's candidacy was helpful in making the legislature a bit more diverse. But unfortunately for her, both of those things got shoved into the back burner because of some statements she has made in the past related to decades-long conflicts in the Middle East.
Indeed. Now, let's state for the record that, of course, political activists can say whatever they want about whatever they want, as long as it's not hate speech. You can certainly be as pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli as you want. I mean, let's face it, there's tens of thousands of Jews in the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem on a regular basis protesting the actions of the Israeli government. So if they can be critical, then surely anyone else can be too. That's not the issue. Some of Jama's comments have been seen by some in the Jewish community in Ontario as not being just anti-Israeli, but rather anti-Semitic. For example, she accused the Hamilton police of targeting Palestinian organizers, saying, quote, "Over and over and over again, the Hamilton police protect Nazism in our city." Then, in referring to Israel, she said, quote, "The same people will continue to fund the killing of people here, locally and globally." New Democrats were worried enough about this that their new leader, Marit Stiles, actually canceled an appearance she was supposed to make with the candidate in Hamilton during the by-election campaign. And then the day before E-Day, Stiles essentially fessed up to the notion that in her candidate's zeal to support the Palestinian cause, she may have crossed the line and said some things that candidates who are actually trying to bring people together maybe shouldn't say.
I think Stiles' actual quote was that sometimes candidates get caught up in the rhetoric of the moment, quote, where maybe we didn't use the right choice of words. Anyway, Stiles met with the head of the Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Center for Holocaust Studies. That's former federal MP Michael Levitt, who said Jama's words had caused pain in the Jewish community. He put this on Twitter after the get-together, saying, quote, following our meeting with ONDP leader Marit Stiles, MPP candidate Sarah Jama has issued an apology for her harmful comments in a video circulating online that party leader Stiles acknowledges caused real concern for members of the Jewish community. And of course, everyone is pledging to do better going forward, but it will be interesting to see what kind of a welcome Jama gets at Queen's Park when she is sworn in.
Well, let me pick up on that, because there is a cabinet minister in Doug Ford's government, the Solicitor General. His name is Michael Kersner. He's the MPP for York Centre. He is Jewish. He wears a skullcap, a yarmulke. There's a tradition that when new members enter the chamber for the first time and assume their place with their caucus, everyone rises and gives them a standing ovation. I imagine many people will be watching to see whether Kersner rises or, if he does, how enthusiastically he applauds for Jama, who, I think it's fair to say, is off to a bit of a rough start in her tenure as a new MPP.
One other point about incoming MPP Jama. We mentioned her use of a wheelchair, and we've mentioned before that Queen's Park is a very old building in need of renovations, and that includes the fact that it's really not built for people with different mobility needs. But the legislative staff have worked with the NDP to ensure that Jama will be able to enter the chamber with her chair, take a place at a desk along with every other MPP in the NDP caucus. Some of this work actually started years ago, and Steve, you might remember that former Liberal MPP Monty Quinter was using a wheelchair in the last bit of his time at Queen's Park. And it turned out Quinter wasn't at Queen's Park very long by then, but the work that legislative staff did to prepare is now being applied for Jama. I'm told that she's actually going to take the place currently held by Peter Tabbins, his desk. She will now take that spot in the legislature. Tabbins, of course, is the former interim leader. So Jama will have a front bench seat, which is a bit of a rare thing for a new MPP. But it will make it possible for her to get her chair in and out of the chamber most easily. I will also add that when it comes time to vote on matters, Jama will not be required to stand as MPPs traditionally do. The rules of the legislature already allow the Speaker to modify procedures to accommodate any MPP with a disability. So JAMA will be allowed to indicate her vote by voice or some other means. Okay, on to issue two.
This week, on Thursday, March 23rd, Finance Minister Peter Bethlenfalvy will rise in the legislature and bring down the province's budget for fiscal year 2023-24. We obviously don't know how much money the Treasurer intends to spend, but last year, he figured out how to allocate almost $190 billion towards programs for Ontarians. We thought it would be useful to try to figure out how the budget actually gets done, since it is one of the most important days on the political calendar for any government.
To that end, we welcome the Finance Minister, Peter Bethlenfalvy, back to the On Poly podcast. Minister Bethlenfalvy was first elected in 2018, and he's the member for Pickering Uxbridge in Durham Region. Welcome back to the podcast.
Well, it's great to be back with you both after a bit of absence of a couple of weeks since you last interviewed me.
Yes, we missed you too much, I guess. Anyway, Treasurer, we're not going to waste your time asking you what's in the budget because we know you're not going to tell us. But we would like to know how you go about putting such a significant document together. So let's start there. We're in March 2023 right now. At what point in the year do you and your team actually begin to start kicking around ideas, canvassing your colleagues, with a view to what will be in the final document?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, it, for a lot of people, it's a mystery. But I got to tell you, so the budget 2024, I already have a binder. I've already started on next year's budget, if you can believe that. So obviously, we start for the fall economic statement coming up at the in November of this year, or it has to be done before November 15th. And the reason for that, you know, a budget isn't one and done. A budget is a continuous, evolving document. So, you know, a couple things you got to have your ear to the ground. First of all, you got to talk to all your constituents. You know, we get elected every 4 years if it's a majority, and then we work for everybody in the province, all 15.2 million people. So what's so critical is that you go out there and you listen and you talk to people, you listen to your caucus, you listen to stakeholders, you listen to the opposition, you listen to all voices because you represent all constituents. And the other thing you do is you take stock of the environment that you're in, because the environment changes. You know, events, dear sir, events really shape how you think. And then the third thing you do, we have a plan to build. So that was our budget last year, which was really our vision for Ontario. And I come from the private sector where it's important to have a long-term vision and a plan, and one that you can keep updating people on. So the third thing is, as you're going through consulting with people, as you're going through taking stock of the events, you also stick to your North Star, your plan, and you read and react to that plan.
I think people would be interested to know whether the budget is really written by staff in your office, or, you know, how much influence the Premier's office have. You know, does the Premier tell you really like what to put in the budget, or do you put it together and then present it to him for his comments?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've learned coming from the private sector is there's many, many inputs into a budget. Clearly, the finance minister has probably the most influence over the document. And the Premier has influence over the document. Caucus has influence over the document, but there are many, many inputs. As you know, we go around the province January and February talking to people. I've done a lot of them myself with COVID. We did a lot on Zoom, but we've started going back out and meeting directly. And those meetings are often 3 hours long, and you get 3 minutes to do a presentation. And those things matter. So you know, listening to people is part of the continuum. That I mentioned, you start on the day after the budget, and there's a process that goes on really for the next 11 months. You have to put your pen down at some point, and that's fair. And we've put our pen down, so you're right. There's not you know, any lobbying that happens. You know, one thing that I would not counsel is coming in the week before the budget and saying, "I really hope this is going to be in the budget." Well, you should be starting that process maybe the day after the budget, because it takes time. And, you know, the finance minister, the premier, there are many stakeholders stakeholders should be talking to, many people. You know, if it's a health item, obviously the minister of health, there's many touch points, local MPPs, whether they're conservative, NDP, or liberal. It's important to have those voices. I was at an event this weekend, and one of my biggest detractors on the NDP side, I said to her, you know, your voice really matters. And she really embraced that, you know, that, you know, you have to listen to everybody. So I think that's part of the ingredients of a good budget. It's listening not just to the finance minister or the premier, but to everybody.
Let me push you a little bit more on that issue of the pre-budget consultations and how much of it is just theater when you're dealing with the public in these public hearings or with your opposition colleagues. And how often do you genuinely get a good idea that comes from a member of the public or the opposition that ends up in the budget?
All the time. So breaking news, Steve, all the time. I hope I'm not smashing one of your conceptions of how budgets are made and it's just theater. No, it really matters. Those consultations in January, February matter. You hear things that could reinforce things that you're hearing. Now you're hearing them from people who are maybe not on the same page as you are or ideologically on the same page, but you hear things. You know, one of the things that I went out to Kitchener very early on when I was elected, and I had a Chamber of Commerce event there, and they said, Minister, we have three priorities in Kitchener, Waterloo, in the Waterloo region. And I said, what's that? And to a broad audience, they said, number one is two-way all-day go. The second priority would be two-way all-day go. And the third priority would be two-way all-day go. So, you know, they put down a marker. And that things don't happen overnight. But, you know, you start to get inputs from various people. And then if that comes up in the budget consultations in January, February, you're hearing from people on the ground. That plays a role. Another example would be the Brampton Hospital, the addition to the Brampton Hospital. You know, there's a town that's grown by leaps and bounds. And, you know, healthcare didn't keep pace with the rapid growth. So that was another thing that you hear through budget consultations that actually turns into reality, including the medical school in Brampton. If I'm on Brampton, you know, we haven't put a new, like, collective we. In 100 years, there's no medical school that's been launched in the GTA. And based on consultations, based on crisscrossing the province, based on input from stakeholders, we launched two new medical universities, one in Scarborough under University of Toronto and one in Brampton under Toronto Metropolitan University. So these things do come about.
Can you give us a sense of which groups are particularly influential when you're seeking advice for what to put in the budget?
That's a great question, John Michael. You know, maybe this is a personal thing for me, but I listen to people who don't have organized voices. I mean, I listen to everybody, but there's something about if you can rally 100,000 people on the front lawn because you're part of some organization, that's one thing. But if you can't, you know, organize a lobby, you don't have the voices, you don't have the organization, that has a big impact on me. And I'll give you an example, cystic fibrosis. So I have a couple people in my riding. Who suffer from cystic fibrosis. No, it doesn't get any attention. We heard very early on from them that there was a drug that was approved by the FDA in the U.S. that wasn't approved in Canada, and it wasn't approved as part of the formulary that would be picked up by Medicare. And so that was what, you know, those types of presentations, those sort of conversations where you couldn't have a big protest on the front lawn of Queen's Park from those constituents, but it really matters. So I listen as closely, if not more closely, to the people who don't necessarily have an organized voice, but their issues are no less important than some of the other issues.
This may be a relatively dumb and obvious question, but it wouldn't be the first time I've done that. And that is, we are sitting here talking on a Monday. You're going to present your budget on a Thursday. Do we assume that the budget is now done, officially put to bed, and will not change between now and then?
Never say never is one thing I've learned in politics. But there is a point in time where the fiscal architecture, the narrative, all the pieces have to come together, and we have it printed. So there's a time you got to print the document. The other thing that I have to go do that I haven't done yet is I'm going to buy some new shoes. Not some secondhand shoes. I like supporting small business, so they will be new shoes that I'll pick up on Thursday.
You know, the reason I asked the question is I remember, and this is probably almost 40 years ago, Mark Lalonde was the federal finance minister at the time, and he did one of his pre-budget day photo ops maybe a day or two ahead of time. And he actually took the real copy of the budget with him for the photo op, one of the camera operators shooting it for the news. zoomed in on the page, saw what the numbers were, put it on the news that night, and Mr. Lalonde was therefore forced in the interim day or two to change the budget so that he could not be accused of leaking his own actual budget. Now, admittedly, that was a bit of a crazy example, but it did remind me that the budget is never totally finished until you actually get up on your feet and read it. So, but you are not anticipating any changes between now and then. That's right, right?
Well, I'll never say never, but, you know, with technology the way it is. But I do remember that. Sadly, I'm in your vintage, and I do remember that. I also remember another finance minister who I think some of the pages went for shredding and were found in a garbage bin. So that causes some consternation. Look, I've got a great team around me, and I make it tough already on my staff. I really, that's one thing they want to make sure that we don't misstep in any way.
That was Ontario's finance, well, they didn't call it finance minister. They called it treasurer back then. This was in the 80s, Frank Miller. And Robert Stevens of the Globe and Mail went through his garbage and found some budget documents there. And the question was that a leak? And therefore, did the minister have to resign? He didn't. And life went on. Anyway, John Michael, back to you.
The budget isn't just a financial document. It's also an important piece of political theater, for lack of a better word. You're going to stand in the legislature and talk for maybe an hour. Your colleagues are going to applaud where appropriate. How do you practice delivering the speech?
Yes, I have. And I would say, you know, this is a serious budget because serious times require a serious budget. And, you know, we are in unprecedented times. And so I'm very thoughtful about how we deliver that. I wouldn't call it theater. I would call it an update on our vision statement, given the environment we're in, to really give people a sense of how we're doing financially, where the priorities of the government are, how we articulate those priorities, and how they match up against our vision, which is really a long-term vision. That plan to build that I tabled back in April of 2022 was a plan for the long-term economic prosperity of the province. So the budget, you know, is going to be very thoughtful and responsive to the environment in this environment, uncertain time, and one where we're staying the course that I will hopefully deliver equally well by practicing it a few times.
No, I appreciate that you say it's not theater, but the fact is you are going to get up in front of an audience. You are going to be on television. You've just told us you're going to practice it a little bit. There are elements of theater in this thing. And I wonder whether you could just peel the curtain back a little bit and tell us, when you practice, for example, do you have advisors who say to you, you know, you really need to punch up this word here, or you need to wait for applause here, or, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, fair question. And yes, the answer is a short answer, yes. In fact, I go to the legislature and I practice it after hours. And so you actually physically go there. And yes, I've got a bunch of people around me who go, you know, make changes on the fly and makes little amendments. But, you know, I've heard many times it's not what you say, it's how you say it, your intonation, your sincerity, your command of the information. So I think I'm a guy who really prepares a lot. I'm like, and my team knows how much I prepare on all things. And I really do go through my files in great detail because I think preparation is such a key part of good execution and delivery. And I think it was Winston Churchill who was not a great public speaker, but boy, did he practice many times intonation and in front of a mirror and over again. And he delivered some of the best speeches known in this last century.
Do you speak to former finance ministers to get their input?
I do. I've talked to many, all parties, because their advice is important because they have the experience. And, you know, sadly, I don't have Michael Wilson, who was one of my political mentors. And we did a podcast, Stephen and John Michael, many at the beginning, about Michael. You know, we've lost Jim Flaherty. So I've reached out to former Liberal prime ministers, Conservative prime ministers, Liberal, NDP, and I've chatted to conservative finance ministers and people on all sides. And the one thing that's in common with all of them, they love to give that advice because it's bigger than they love to give advice because that's who they are by nature. But the point I wanted to make was that they love this country. And they did public service, and they know how tough public service is. You know, when you put your name on a ballot, you know, you've got certain capital going into an election. And if you get elected, you know, that capital's beaten up, your personal capital's beaten up the whole time. And so they know what public service is about. They know why they did the jobs and endured, their families endured some of the hardships that political life gives. And so they give freely of their thought, their time, and their advice. And I think that's what makes this country and this province so terrific against a lot of other countries that don't have that sort of culture and institutional.
Let me ask you about Thursday itself. You're going to be available to journalists in the virtual lockup to answer questions. You then give the speech in the House. You then have to do, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 one-on-one interviews with various news outlets around the province. No doubt you've got other meetings during the day as well. Can you tell us what the best and worst parts of Budget Day itself are?
I remember very clearly in the fall economic statement, I did 23 media interviews, TV and radio, and my 23rd was a fellow who anchored the agenda. We did that the next morning, so that was the 23rd. So hopefully by then I'm on message. I think the biggest challenge is to stay on message and to stay on message for 23. Interviews. You know, you can say a lot of things. The budget last year was 241 pages, I believe, or maybe that was the fall economic statement. So there's a lot of information in there. You can go a lot of places, but it's important that you stick to the message. So that's the biggest challenge. The funnest part is revealing what's in the budget. You know, obviously, you've worked on it for basically a year. You have the fall economic statement, which is a place that we update, but really the budget contains the legislative and financial forecast of the whole province and what the government's priorities are. Short of the phone speech, it's the most significant document that we table. So for me, the fun part is at 4 o'clock. And of course, I get to read it, so I can't make any mistakes. I'm pretty well on there. In 23 interviews, you know, there's many places where you could go, and you challenge to stay on message is the biggest thing.
Minister of Finance, Peter Bethlenfalvy, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Before you say goodbye, this is your last chance to fess up to something in the budget ahead of time if you want to do it. We'll give you that chance right here.
Give us a scoop. Give us a scoop.
Okay, breaking news for just here on Pakin and McGrath's podcast. The budget will be tabled on March 23rd.
Wow, this just in, everybody. You heard it here first.
Minister, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Happy to do it. My pleasure.
This is Volkswagen's first overseas EV battery manufacturing plant right here in Ontario.
Last week, Volkswagen announced that a subsidiary of theirs, PowerCo, will be opening a battery plant in St. Thomas, Ontario. This will bring back automotive jobs to the area that once had the St. Thomas Assembly, which closed back in 2011. Around 2,500 jobs are expected once the plant is fully opened in two or so years. Das Auto, das good news for Ontario, right, Steve?
Ausgezeichnet, mein good Freund. Or one might even say electrifying. Not bad German there, I got to say, McGrath. That was okay. This is where I do one of these full disclosure things, because as we talk about this, I should point out I drive a Chevy Volt. I have driven the same Chevy Volt. It's a hybrid, battery powered, but also with an internal combustion engine. I've had one for 11 years, I think, quite like it. I guess one of the first people here to get one of these battery-powered cars. And since then, there has been quite an explosion of interest from automakers to start producing electric vehicles. This latest investment represents... Actually, you know what? We don't know. We don't know the details yet, as the deal is apparently still underway. And we know there are a lot of privacy concerns about how much money the respective governments are putting into this. But why don't we start with this? What do we actually know about the nature of the agreement between... Drivers Wanted, and the province of Ontario?
What we do know is that negotiations started about a year ago, and there was a huge competition between Canada and the United States to woo the German automaker. Of course, this is all happening in the context of the Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S., which has laid out billions and billions of dollars in subsidies for industry generally, but the auto industry in particular. According to a report from the Toronto Star, Vic Fedeli, the Minister of Economic Development and Job Creation and Trade for Ontario, traveled to Germany several times as part of the efforts to woo Volkswagen. And apparently Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, was personally involved in the effort as well.
Well, as we've seen on these stories, it's kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach by both federal, provincial, and in this case, municipal governments as well. But we don't really know exactly how much money taxpayers are putting into this deal. Do we have a good ballpark on that?
According to the press release from the province, Canada and Ontario have garnered $17 billion in investment from global automakers in creating electric vehicle batteries and battery materials. Companies like Stellantis, which makes Dodge and Chrysler and LG, have also announced electric vehicle battery plans in Windsor. Ontario is also home to the area that we talked about before, the Ring of Fire, which Premier Ford has pledged $1 billion to create more road access to. There was actually just an announcement a week or two ago about approving the environmental assessment for that road project, just to improve the mining sector's access to the region in the hopes of generating $10 billion of annual mineral production. So you can see, you know, the outlines of what the Ford government would really love to see, ideally, which is a booming auto sector in southern Ontario, a huge demand for electric vehicle batteries, and that would then drive both an increase in manufacturing employment in southern Ontario, but also a boom in mineral demands from northern Ontario. Lithium and chromite and nickel all potentially feeding into that battery supply in the south. The southwest and the north really were I think it's fair to say they were left out of a lot of the economic growth of the past decade, which was really clustered in Toronto, the GTA, and Ottawa. So you can see why people in government, and this is really, you know, this would be an appealing vision regardless of which party was in power, you could see why they find it so compelling.
I notice in the government's press releases, though, that they say they've drawn in $17 billion worth of economic activity from the automakers, both in auto parts manufacturing, auto assembly, battery manufacturing, but they don't say how much they put in. And it's you know, we know it's hundreds of millions of dollars, but they're being very unspecific about those amounts because they say they're in negotiations with other auto manufacturers and they, you know, that's all proprietary information. Do we buy that?
Well, it certainly, you could understand that the government doesn't want to declare open season on its own wallet by announcing how much money it's willing to give to automakers. I do think that within the auto sector, though, they all understand at the moment, the companies all understand that what the Americans are spending, it has really given automakers the upper hand in these kinds of negotiations, because everybody can go to not just Ottawa and Queen's Park, but they can go to Berlin or Paris or London and say, well, either you hand over tax dollars or we're just going to go locate our new facility in the southern U.S.
Oklahoma City, I gather, was one of the spots they were looking at for this Volkswagen battery plant. But for whatever reason, Ontario got it instead. Now, let's talk about the Ring of Fire, because there certainly has been a hope by successive governments about turning the Ring of Fire into part of the mining hub that would be the province of Ontario, as you point out, competing with other jurisdictions around the world for that. Talk to us a bit about that, if you would.
Well, obviously, there are environmental concerns. The idea of turning the Ring of Fire into this mining hub, as you put it, you know, we talked about the need for road access. Obviously, if you're cutting road through northern boreal forest, that is intrinsically going to have an environmental impact. And then there's all the other infrastructure that it would need, including electrical infrastructure. Some of that is already being built as part of the Watay Power project. But you know, there's sensitive ecologies in the north, you know, peatlands that sequester carbon. The forests themselves are enormous sequestered stocks of carbon. Premier Ford has said that his government also is working closely with Indigenous communities and First Nations to drive the Ring of Fire project forward. But Indigenous affairs are not purely a provincial matter. And a letter last year sent by several First Nations to the federal government said that the environmental and geographic assessments being done are too narrow on the provincial side of things and are excluding some Indigenous communities from anything but what are called token rules.
Well, let's pause on that for a second, because the current federal government is seen by some as being not quite as enthusiastic about mining in the north as the Ontario government is. And both Indigenous reconciliation and environmental protection are areas where Ottawa just might put its foot down and say they're going to take a closer look at some of these projects. What are the implications of that?
You know, as much as the Prime Minister is a big fan of green energy and the jobs that come with it, there are a lot of different tensions working sometimes across purposes here. There's definitely an economic push to develop areas like the Ring of Fire and other projects across the north. Lithium-ion batteries are undeniably important for the auto sector and industry more broadly. But, you know, does the environmental damage being done to create these resources negate either in part or overall the impact that selling more electric vehicles could have? Maybe we should be thinking about other strategies for climate change, right? Should we be investing more in public transit? Although at the moment, the Ontario government is spending quite a great deal on public transit, you know, heat pumps for home heating and cooling, trying to convince people to drive less. You mentioned your electric vehicle. I also own an electric vehicle. I bought myself an e-bike last year, and it has gotten me to TVO for all of my commutes this winter, except for two, which is important for two reasons. One, I get to feel the smugness of all winter cyclists. but two, I do think policymakers really haven't grasped just how much is happening in what is called micro-mobility, which is like e-bikes, scooters, so on. These are increasingly popular ways to get around. But for our purposes, one thing they all have in common is that they need much, much less lithium to move a person. So how popular they get, not just here, but worldwide, could materially change how much lithium we need to mine and process.
Good stuff. That is the On Poly podcast for March 21st, 2023. Please make sure you stay tuned after the credits for a special interview with Nam Kiwanuka from TVO's The Thread. We're going to talk about the latest episode on Ontario's growing doctor shortage. Remember to check out our newsletters. You can subscribe at tvo.org/newsletters. This week, JMM and I riff on the Toronto mayor's race, which has, with Anna Bylaw's entry into it, really started to heat up. No doubt, many, many more quality candidates to come. So we talk about that in this week's newsletter.
Any feedback you have, we are always happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org. This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara. Our managing editor is Shayar Tejvidi.
Production support from Nikki Ashworth, Carla Lucchetta, and Jonathan Halliwell. COVID is not over yet, people, so let's remember, as my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.
This month, The Thread with Nam Kiwanuka is focusing in on Ontario's doctor shortage. It's a problem that's existed for decades, but it's ever more in the spotlight, especially with that report we talked about last week from Ontario's Financial Accountability Office. It said the province will need to spend more than $21 billion over the next few years to keep up with the demand for hospital beds, long-term care homes, nurses, and doctors, and so on.
Joining us now to talk more about this is The Thread's host, Nam Kiwanuka. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me,
there
guys.
There she is. Hi, Nam Shine.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Just grand. All the better for seeing you. Let's get into this month's topic. What have you discovered about all of this?
Well, if you have a family doctor, it might feel like you've won the lottery. In 2019, StatsCan stated that 1.3 million patients in Ontario are without a family doctor. That number jumped to 1.8 million in March of 2020. And it is now estimated to be higher at 2.2 million people. 1.7 million Ontarians will see their family doctors retiring over the next 2 years. So that number, obviously, is going to grow. And only 30% of students in Canada ranked family medicine as their top choice.
Yikes.
Part of this episode took you to Marmora, Ontario, which is north of Belleville. What does the doctor shortage look like in smaller towns?
Well, the official name of the town is Marmora and Lake. The two townships amalgamated in 2001 to become one town. There are about 4,000 people who live there. We spoke to one of two doctors, a senior who has been looking for a doctor for years. We also spoke with the mayor, Jan O'Neill, and spoke to a small business owner by the name of Connor, who has asthma and sleep apnea, but he's been looking for a doctor for 2 to 3 years now.
Are there any incentives they can offer that will actually make a difference and get doctors to move there and practice?
Oh, yes. They are really trying, and they've been doing this for about 2 years now. The town is offering a bonus of $280,000 alongside free accommodation and office space. The current doctors came to the town on similar initiatives. There's also a nurse practitioner in the practice. And as I said, they're looking to replace two physicians, and that has been going on for years. The bonus is offered in collaboration with the county, Hastings, the town of Marmoran Lake itself, plus the province is contributing money as well.
Who's most at risk in this crisis? Obviously, we have an aging population, but are there other demographics who need the care that aren't getting it?
Definitely our seniors, our elders. Marmara has an aging population. The alternatives right now, is if you don't have a doctor, is to drive to a nearby hospital or a doctor. No public transit. And if you don't drive or have access to a driver or a car, your mobility to seek care elsewhere is greatly limited. Single men are also at an at-risk population. They end up going to a doctor when something might become life-threatening. The young man we spoke to, Connor, he's a farmer, but he also runs an auto body shop. Lots of physical and dangerous work. He had an accident, and part of his finger was cut off. His mom managed to get, was actually coming to see him with food, and she got him to a hospital. But he wasn't able to have surgery for nearly 2 weeks. So in the time he was waiting, he was in a lot of pain and he was unable to work. I actually said that's kind of like adding salt to the wound. He goes, literally. So the time that he was waiting for the surgery, they had to clean his wound out with iodine every day. And he also said he can't afford to get sick or be out sick because it means that his workload just continues to grow. And he's not just falling back a day or two, it's weeks and even months.
Well, let's talk solutions. We talked about incentives that are being offered to get doctors to these smaller parts of Ontario. Other ideas. What can Ontario do to get ahead of this?
I don't know if ahead is the way to say it. It seems like we're behind. We looked at two solutions, training of foreign doctors and nurse practitioner-led clinics. Some estimates show that there are some 13,000 foreign-trained physicians living in the province, but they're not practicing medicine. They are instead driving Ubers, working in retail, or doing what they can to make ends meet.
What a waste of talent, eh?
And they feel it, too. They told me that it's like a moral injury because they have the skill and the talent and the desire to help people, but they have to sit on the sidelines. The one doctor we spoke to, she was trained in Jamaica. She said during the pandemic, it was really difficult for her emotionally to not be able to help in the way that she could. So this particular doctor, she studied in Jamaica. She moved here because her mom is here. But now she's considering leaving Ontario and moving to the US or the UK. And that means that we have lost one more potential doctor. I was surprised to learn that Ontario makes it much harder for foreign-trained doctors to practice than other provinces like, say, Nova Scotia. The other solution that we looked at is to increase the number of nurse practitioner-led clinics in the province. Currently, there are 25 such clinics in Ontario. We went to one in Waterloo Region and found out that nurse practitioners can not only fill in the gaps of the shortage of primary care physicians, but that patients can also thrive in those clinics because they offer patients an entry point into the healthcare system. As we know, you can't just go see a specialist. You need your primary care provider to
they're the gatekeepers.
Yeah, to point you the right way.
Yep.
I should also add that when I asked the physician from Jamaica that we spoke to if she would consider moving to Marmara to practice, and she said she would jump at the opportunity.
What's at stake here if we, the collective we in Ontario, don't figure this out?
I mean, I don't mean to sound alarmist or naive, but I think everything is at stake. Maybe when we were in our 20s, we didn't appreciate our health. But the three of us are a certain age, and we all know that without health, there is nothing. And getting access to healthcare shouldn't be dependent on where you live in this province. We know the horrific stories of places in the north where you have to get sometimes on a plane to access healthcare. It becomes a question of equity. The solution is not for people to move and leave their communities behind in order to access health care. We know what that has done for the housing crisis, unintended consequences. And the people we spoke to in Marmara were fourth, fifth, and sixth generation. They love their town. They look out for each other. What they don't get from the provincial or federal governments, they give to each other. For example, you know, driving a neighbor to an appointment for care.
Okay, lots of different ways to watch the thread. Lay it on us. Where can we see this episode? Because this sounds very timely and very important.
Well, the next episode goes live on March 26th at 7 p.m. on TVO. You can watch it on the TV if you have a TV.
Kids don't have TVs anymore now. I watch television, but kids don't. Okay.
Same. And you can also stream on the YouTube's on the Threads YouTube channel and the TVO website. We have additional content on our Instagram page where we communicate directly with our viewers and host our Instagram chats. We have one this Wednesday with Global Mail reporter Carly Weeks, who will give us some insight into the doctor shortage across the country, and it will be live at 7 p.m.
Nam Kiwanuka, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Nam Shine. Great to have you here.
Appreciate it.